Welcome along to Tom Deacon Deconstructs, the podcast where I ask my guests what inspires and motivates them. So great to have you back for another episode. I hope you're well. Do you know what? That's one of those statements that sounds so disingenuous. However, I really do mean it. Thank you for your comments I received after my last guest, Jess Leodan, was on. Those of you who were unaware of his story told me they found it fascinating. So I really appreciate that. On iTunes, you know what? It was nice to get a review that said, a cracking find. That brought a smile to my face. So cheers for that, P. Longers. They reviewed the Gordon Strachan episode, which reminds me, if you do enjoy today's episode, please give it a review or tell someone to give it a listen. Word of mouth is always the best, in my opinion. Right then, to my guest today. I really am looking forward to you meeting her. I first came across her work a few years ago when I was hosting a Saints Foundation charity dinner, and she was overseeing the menu and the food that night. MasterChef winner in 2012, an author, restaurant owner, and above all, a genuine person who I know you'll be inspired by. Today's guest is Shalina Permalloo. We talk about her experiences growing up in Southampton, where she gets her inspiration for recipes, the tricky subject of the word diet, and her hopes for the future, to list but just a few of the things. For the life of me, I'm not sure why I started the conversation like this.
I want to tell you what I just ate for lunch and get your take on it.
on, <then. laughs>
Okay, so it's a chickpea curry with garam masala, onions, a bit of cumin, all the spices added in. And then with rice is added a bit of spinach. And then, I don't know why, but a bit of hummus on the side seems to go down very well. So I don't know what nationality of a dish that is, but it's got a bit of everything.
Middle East meets Indian.
And I feel like I know you now. I know it sounds very odd, but doing so much like research, that's kind of one of the things I like to do with the podcast, is to know about everybody. And
I feel nervous now.
You oh, no. No, not at all. One thing I did was I went on all the podcasts that you've appeared on iTunes. I'm sure there's more.
Oh, I had no idea that there is such a thing.
What? Yeah.
I'm old school. Like, I barely know about any of these things. So I don't know where I am.
So I was able to understand the recipe for the egg rougail, which sounds absolutely delicious, I have to say.
Yeah, it's a delicious and staple recipe. It's one of those, it's a speedy midweek supper, or it's like a Sunday brunch type of meal. So yeah, that's our go-to. It's such a classic Mauritian dish.
Yeah, and then I think it changed my world. The first thing I said to Georgie, my girlfriend, is I said, look, if you add salt immediately in with the onions, it takes the moisture out. So it's a game changer, I have to say. So listen, Shalina, there's so much I want to ask you about. But first of all, I wanted to, as two people who grew up in Southampton, when people ask you about Southampton, what does that conjure in your mind? Why is Southampton important to you?
Oh, I have such fond memories of Southampton. I think our city is sort of underrepresented on a national scale. I think there's a lot that our city has to offer. I live in Ocean Village, so I'm currently looking out at the beautiful marina, and everyone's on their boats right now, so they're all enjoying themselves. But yeah, there's a lot to Southampton. You know, the accessibility to the forest, it's really quick to get to London. But it has changed a lot. I have to say that I really love Southampton now. I think growing up, it was quite a different kind of small town, I think, which is the reason why I actually left Southampton originally when I was about 18. I got accepted to go to Brunel University over in West London. And that's where my love of London and sort of diversity and food all sort of really kind of sped up, I suppose.
Because when I grew up in Southampton, I knowing and working with you, well, indirectly at the Saints Foundation charity dinner, I sort of was thinking about my experiences of diversity growing up in Southampton, because we're only a few years apart. And I was always very fortunate, I think, growing up in Southampton. I getting to know different cultures through food is what I'm so proud of at Southampton. You know, I could tell you where the best samosas are to get in Southampton. It's the international store down in Newtown. That's the best place to get your veggie samosas. But it's sort of, did you not experience that, I guess, in Southampton?
No, I did. But I think something about London, in the sense that, you know, you have every single type of ethnic cuisine that you could possibly imagine. So Southampton, you kind of need to know where to go. So, you know, you know where to go for your West Indian food, you know where to go for, your, you know, the best Punjabi food or the, you know, things like that. So you sort of know. But when I got to London, it was like, oh my goodness, there's an Eritrean restaurant. And, you know, it's things like that that make such a big difference, because unless you know an Eritrean, how would you even know about their food, if that makes sense? So London really inspired me, obviously helped me with my journey with MasterChef, made me realize kind of where I wanted to go. But Southampton was a really good sounding board.
Yeah. And now, obviously, and I want to talk to you about it, you've gone back to Southampton to open your restaurant, which La Case Maman, which translates as Mum's House. So you've gone back. Was there part of you that you wanted to bring more, a little bit extra diversity, add a new flavor to Southampton?
Yeah, absolutely. And I am proud of being from Southampton. You know, I always spoke about it in all of my press stories. And even when I was growing up and everyone was like, where are you from? I'm like, Southampton. And, you know, the only thing that we would talk about is that's where the Titanic set sail. But I wanted there to be so much more of our story. And I just love the idea of returning back to Southampton and setting up my own restaurant. Everyone had a preconception that winning MasterChef would mean that you would automatically open up a fine dining, top of the range restaurant, you know, millions and millions of pounds to open. But I really didn't want that. And I'm quite humble in the way that I approach food. And I really wanted people to have a humble experience of my food. So I came back to Southampton and I looked at lots of different areas, and Bedford Place had memories for me, you know, old school memories. If we're not too far apart in age, then you remember that that was like the clubbing bar scene.
Yes.
And then there was like a strip of kebab joints, which were always really fond memories of post clubs. But it was nothing much more than that. And what I love about London is places like that can be transformed into really hip, trendy, independent scenes. And it takes one or two people to kind of nosedive into the area and change it around. And actually, I took the restaurant on, I actually got the property 5 years ago, and we opened 4 years ago. And I was one of the first independent restaurants in that area. There were many others, but I mean for international cuisine. And since then, you know, we've seen a wave of new kind of faces in the area. And I just think it's got a lot going for itself now, as being an alternative area for, you know, for different types of food.
Yeah, I while you're talking and mentioning Bedford Place, I just have these images now of when I was growing up there.
You don't want to replicate those images, I'm sure.
Definitely not. No, perfect. So you moved to London, and I suppose, is that where you got involved with more diversity in terms of women and getting more people from ethnic backgrounds into roles in business? Is that where that took off for you?
Yeah, so basically, I actually worked in Southampton briefly after uni. So I studied psychology. So I was really interested in social change. That was kind of my area of interest. And I moved back to Southampton for a short period, for about 2.5-3 years. And I worked on a diversity and housing project. And then I relocated to London and worked on diversity and equality. That was my area of expertise. And I stayed in that field up until I did MasterChef. So up until I turned 30, basically. But prior to that, you know, being interested in diversity means that you are open to exploring everything. And that particularly meant that I was open to exploring lots of different food. And being in London meant that I could kind of really satisfy that. I was actually Southwest London as well, so very close to you. So I lived in Clapham and then moved along the line, down the Northern Line. So I moved to Tooting and then finally over to Balham.
Wow. Tooting is the bring your own booze area, capital, I think, of London, where some of the most incredible Sri Lankan restaurants are amazing diversity as well. But I was trying to avoid asking you about MasterChef as long as possible. the reason that it, I imagine the question that gets asked a lot, but say someone was to meet you, how would you introduce yourself to them? And they said, what do you do, Shalina?
I say I'm a cook. Okay. So I say that before anyone sort of, I don't like to mention MasterChef to anyone until they sort of say, oh gosh, you look really familiar. And then I sort of say, oh, do you know the restaurant La Casa Mama? And they'll say, yeah. And they'll say, oh my God, you're the woman from MasterChef. So that's kind of how it goes. I don't like to be the first one to mention it because it may well be they remember me from school or they remember me from the local Tesco's around the corner from here. So yeah, normally I call myself a cook and an author. Those are kind of the two things. And then a business person, I think I can be a jack of all trades, really.
Yeah, it's funny how people deal with that, I guess, the fame that goes with the association. But I suppose it's a nice feeling that they remember you from 2012. You were the first woman to win after 8 years of men winning, and then the first woman of color as well. So that must be a proud moment for you as well.
Absolutely. And actually, I think it was really sort of exasperated by the fact that I spent all that time working in diversity and inclusion. And when I ended up winning the show, I thought, oh my God, I'm a woman of color winning a national, you know, BBC cooking competition. I'm completely bowled over by this. And it was quite random. I wasn't expecting it. I genuinely never thought that our food, you know, the food from Mauritius would be enough to win the show, because traditionally on the show, you would find that the winners were along the very European lines, or not necessarily always, but the majority, I'd say, would be aligned to the classics, where Mauritian food is a real melting pot. It's quintessential, world cuisine, really. It's what you really call diversity on a plate. So I never really expected this food to be the thing that could win the trophy, really.
I mean, because it's African, it's Creole, it's Indian, it's French, it's Chinese. Like you say, it's a melting pot. How did you find Southampton took to your food? Because my own experience of growing up there, it was really hard to get people to try something different because they stick to the classic. So maybe in some respects, that's what allowed you to win MasterChef, because it was so new, it's so exciting. You brought a warmth and people were like, yeah, why not? Let's try that. Is that what you found from the people in Southampton when you opened your restaurant?
Yeah, I was really nervous because actually there was two kind of sides to me. There was a side that, you know, the Shalina opening a restaurant in London, the food was going to be really, really different. And then I thought, right, if I'm opening in Southampton, I'm going to need to tone it down a little bit. And I was very, very conscious of it. I thought, you know, people are going to feel overwhelmed by all the spices and the seasoning and the flavors and the chili. So I dumbed it down. And in the first 2 to 3 months, I was working at the restaurant as a head chef, as well as everything else. I did everything there. But basically, whilst I was working there, I was trying to tone things down. And the feedback I was getting from my customers were actually what we were expecting it to be a bit more powerful. We were expecting this. And it made me rejig my concept, which was going to be the original concept, which is give it all I've got. And I then spent the next 6 months figuring out what people were expecting. And I went straight back to my Mauritian roots, which was, you know, modern Mauritian with those twists, you know, things that you wouldn't ordinarily find in other restaurants. So I'm really proud that I've managed to, you know, add the seasoning, add the chili, add the flavor without being scared of how people would respond.
Yeah, I suppose with food, if it's safe, I can get that safe meal somewhere else. So I suppose you need to stand out, you know, and I guess bring joy to people who haven't experienced those flavors. I mean, how would you tone a meal down? I'm curious.
So I am a woman who doesn't do one clove of garlic, for example. So, you know, if I'm going to make a recipe at home, I'm going to add in, you know, like last night I did some lamb in the oven. I made like a Greek lamb dish and I added a whole bulb of garlic. So, and that's me being naturally me, where that's where all the flavor, I add more flavor than ordinary. It's just because that's what I'm used to. You know, if there's a recipe and it says add one clove of garlic, I'm like, I'm not really sure about this recipe.
what are you afraid of? Stop holding back on this recipe, you know, let's have two cloves.
However, there are some recipes that I have written in the past where I've put in one clove of garlic, because I know that people at home may be really put off by a recipe that has, you know, if I actually said what I put in there, which would be, you know, a classic chili paste in Mauritius, for example, to make one jar, let's say 300 grams, in that would go around, you know, 12 cloves of garlic and around 10 red chilies. And it seems really extreme, but it's not. That's how we get all the flavor in our food. So yeah, in terms of toning down, I wouldn't put the same amount of seasoning. I wouldn't balance it in the same way. I'd want it maybe to be a bit more sweet than it would be hot. So it's things like that that I was really conscious of. But ever since I opened and I got feedback and we did lots of taste testings with all my staff are amazing. You know, they're really, really honest. So if I come up with an idea, and I'm not arrogant enough to think that all my ideas are the best. If I come up with an idea and let everyone taste it and they're like, nah, we don't think that's going to work, then I accept that and we'll move on and like reframe it, kind of thing. So yeah, it's a lot of trial and error, I would say.
I suppose that I'm curious to know where that creativity, that where do you get inspired when it comes to cooking? You're bringing Mauritius food to Southampton, and which you have done for the last 5 years. So where does it come from? Is it and I suppose from your mother, your aunt, who you learned to cook from? You know, maybe that's all done in the first year, then where do you get your inspiration to go forward?
I can't remember where I learned this, but I was told that if you ever lose your creativity in food, travel. So you just travel. And the minute you start to travel, you go to a market, you taste something different, your brain starts ticking again. And so whenever I need that injection of culture and identity to kind of really get my creative juices going, then I'll just hop on the plane and go back to Mauritius. So when I go back to Mauritius, I look around the markets, I smell things, I chat to chefs, I chat to aunties, I chat to the elders, and the recipes just seem to never stop. I think there's a much wider diaspora of Indian Ocean cuisine, which I try and explore at the restaurant. So I take the flavors of Mauritius, but I sort of pair them with things that may not necessarily only be found in Mauritius. So yeah, I think it's a really, it's a creative industry, really.
So just hopping on a plane is the answer for you if there's a moment where you're thinking, I'm just not getting that creative vibe or energy. What do you do now in the current climate where that can't happen for a little while?
Oh, I've been so creative. It's been really interesting, actually. Lockdown has kind of been the opposite of what I thought it would be, which was going to be really difficult, really challenging. But I found it really creative, only because in the first couple of weeks of lockdown, I had so many people ask me to help them with recipes at home. So in the first 6 weeks, I was posting a video or a recipe every couple of days, which was my lockdown cooking series. And it was just amazing to be able to share really, really simple recipes that people could recreate at home with their family. I did the 5-ingredient curry, for example, which completely shocked everyone. They were like, what? No onions? What's going on here? And, you know, it was just such a simple recipe that, and I've got people who have never cooked curry before in their lives saying, wow, you've really inspired me. My family loved this meal. So it's been it's just been amazing, really. So I have been thinking differently about the way that I cook and the way that people receive my recipes. So I've had lots of time to, I say lots of time, I've got a 3-year-old, but she turned 3 during lockdown. So I have lots of time in the evening when she's asleep, but no time during the day.
No, I can imagine. And I, actually looking into your story and your experiences, when maybe 3 months, 4 months into opening the restaurant, you realized you were pregnant, which I guess for those that don't understand how difficult the restaurant business is, not the ideal timing when you're starting the biggest creative project.
No, but equally, it would have been one of those things that it would have never have been the right time. So it was taken out of my hands completely. So my first baby is Laka's mama, and then I ended up being pregnant. So I had two babies in one go. But it didn't stop. I mean, I think it was 2 weeks after giving birth, I just strapped the baby up on the baby carrier on my chest, and we just went back into the restaurant chatting to customers, got into the kitchen, and the chef was like, can you get out of here? You need to look after your child. But it was quite funny because she's always grown up around food. She's grown up in the restaurant. Even when the restaurant closed, she didn't understand. She said, "Mummy, why is La Case Mama not open? Where are all the customers?" She said, "Where are all the people eating?" That's what she said. So we would pop in every week and check up on everything. And I have some ice cream left in the freezer that she's been eating slowly throughout lockdown. So we'll go in, I'll make her an ice cream cone with some sprinkles. And, you know, we just sit there. And it's been bittersweet, I think, the lockdown in terms of the restaurant industry for sure. But it's also provided that time at home that I really needed, which I never get.
I mean, with your cooking, as you said, there's no airs and graces about you. It encompasses who you are, and it's about those creating memories and people. And I think it's fantastic to see on your Instagram that you're able to keep those memories still going, like you say about the 5-ingredient curry. And also, if your daughter wasn't part of it, it wouldn't feel part of the family. That's how food can be for so many people, and it evokes memories. So it would be odd if you weren't in the restaurant still with your daughter.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think the food that I create is food that I want people to feel safe and comfortable with. And when I say safe and comfortable, it's almost like that feeling of you going back to your parents' house or somewhere that reminds you of home, your grandparents, your auntie, your uncle, whoever it was that, you know, was most loved to you growing up. And that feeling of kicking back and relaxing, you know, you take your shoes off and you relax, and then, you know, they bring you a plate of food. And it's that moment, it's that feeling that I want to be able to recreate with my food.
I find it very difficult when I'm in my own house, I'm cooking, I'm constantly thinking, what am I going to cook? How am I going to cook it? It excites me. But the moment you get back to your parents, you switch off. You're just in relax mode. It's like you're on holiday.
Absolutely. And that's the reason why I called it La Case Mama. It's mum's house. So even me, you know, I go to my mum's house and I just switch off. Like, I go brain dead, and mum just brings me a plate of something, and I'm like, oh, this is the best meal ever. I feel so chill. And that's it. That is the moment. And it's that moment of pure comfort and pure indulgence and just, you know, relax, really.
When I see your journey from moving to London, as you say, you were studying down in Southampton, your psychology and moving into that world of diversity. And then you win MasterChef 2012. Then there's this kind of moment where you brought out your book. It's the traditional trajectory for chefs who win. It's like you've got so much to say and share. So you brought out Sunshine on a Plate, which is about creating that simple, vibrant cooking from the cooking to warm the heart. I think it's on the book. You bring out that, and then you move to your next book, which is The Sunshine Diet. And I think what I wanted to ask about that is the difference in your food, and food's so diverse. If for people, it can be seen as guilt often comes about when we talk about food. And I'm just curious to know what you intended to do with that book, The Sunshine Diet.
So initially, so the first book is a Mauritian cookbook with a few twists. That's kind of the best way to describe it. And it is, it's cooking for the soul. And then the second book is, I actually lost a lot of weight, and it was born to kind of more conscious choices around food. So after I did MasterChef, I basically lost 4 stone, and it wasn't even, you know, it happened so quickly. And so my publisher said, you know, this would be a really great recipe book. And so we ended up debating. I wanted it to be a world cuisine book, which was, you know, a taste of the world, essentially, because the food that I cook is Mauritian food exclusively at the restaurant. But the food that inspires me is, you know, Southeast Asia, Africa, India, places that I travel to and want to continue to travel to. So I wanted the recipe book to reflect that. But because I'd lost so much weight, they really wanted the diet word in there, which was a point of contention. I didn't think that the word diet was necessarily, it wasn't the reason why I wanted the name of that book, if that makes sense. Mm. I think it could have been called something different. It's not really a diet book. It is a recipe book packed full of flavor and food. And conceptually, it's about recipes that actually don't use very much butter. They're not very carb heavy and things like that. So you can eat lots of them. And because they're vibrant and colorful, you can eat lots of them without feeling full too quickly. You know, you can eat lots throughout the day, basically. So I think that's kind of what the recipe book was about. So you'll find things in there that are Moroccan inspired, Chinese inspired, Thai, Indian. Just lots of wonderful recipes that are just nourishing and delicious.
I happen to have interviewed a few other chefs and talking about that food. And as soon as you put the diet word, it just immediately sounds unfun. But you can't say how great food is without some people thinking, well, what is the calorie content of that? And it's a real fine line to say, just enjoy that. It's balance, indulge, feel really good, like you say, nourish the soul. But I guess what was the main contentions with that word, putting diet in it, that you felt, I don't know, maybe as a woman in the media and how that just feels like you have to do that in some respects?
Yeah, I think the choice was made really more by the publisher. I didn't really want it to be focused on the word diet. I think there was more, for me, it was more about nourish, you know, nourish your soul, really. And I do think that there is a misinterpretation that when you bring the word diet in, it forces people to have an unhealthy relationship with food, which is definitely not what people deserve to have. And I'm someone who fluctuates in weight. You know, there are times when I'm super happy and I eat lots, and there's times when I'm exhausted and I don't eat very much. And I've actually put on quite a lot of weight after giving birth, which is really absolutely normal. But women shouldn't feel guilty about any of those things. And we shouldn't be kind of fat trashed, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, and that does happen in social media very often. I got quite a lot of abuse online, actually, when I first won MasterChef based on my physical appearance, just because I was a bigger woman. And I'm lucky because I do have thick skin, but I can see how detrimental those kind of words can be to people's, so, you know, self-esteem and their aspirations, really. So yeah, I do think the word diet is counterproductive. I think there's many other beautiful words in the English language that could try and encapsulate what delicious, nourishing food can be. And then also think about it as, I always think about Southeast Asia when I went to Thailand, and everyone is chowing down all day, every day. You know, they're eating all sorts of food all day, every day. And no one is particularly obese. Yeah. I remember looking around thinking, wow, these people look amazing. I need to eat what they're eating. And it was the fact that they were eating these beautifully fresh and fragrant dishes, you know, light soups, lots of protein, lots of vegetables, lots of herbs, and a carb was always being used, but I didn't see it being carb heavy. You know, and there wasn't lots of butter being used in food, and there was just a different type of food that was being eaten. You know, and I was always curious about that. So yeah, I do think that there are other ways of injecting flavor into food, which doesn't necessarily always mean, you know, the real kind of fat laden things such as butter and cream, which is a very Western concept when it comes to food anyway. That's really where the classics were born. And I was never that type of chef.
No, but they're so good though, Shalina. They're so good.
Oh my God. I mean, I had this morning, I had some leftover roti, which is a flatbread, and I just piled over like around a tablespoon of butter over one, unadulterated, absolute bliss. And I don't feel guilty about it. I think, well, I'm going to have that for breakfast, and then I'll have a really different, you know, a lighter lunch. And it's just choices that you make in the day.
Of course. I think it's really interesting when, especially with social media, when you don't want to pass judgment on people, because I think not that there's no need for it, but to pass judgment on how someone enjoys that meal or one day of the week has got nothing to, we assume maybe that's all the time, but it's not, it's passing that judgment. And when you say about life at 100 miles per hour and you've tried to get that balance back into your life, the fact that people would even comment on your appearance on social media is just, I find very challenging. I mean, I've experienced certain things when I was at Radio 1, and you're kind of like, people take the time out to tell you how to live your life, it's quite hard not to take it on board sometimes or to be affected by it.
Absolutely. And it's quite funny because you do take it with a pinch of salt, but once in a while I do snap back. I think I posted, I can't quite remember what it was. I think it might have been a cake recipe. I'm assuming it was a cake. My cakes and puddings are like over the top extravagant. So, I mean, they got to be. If you're going to have a cake or a pudding, you've got to go all out. So I think, I can't remember what I posted, but it was on my Facebook and someone said, sorry, dear, you're head for diabetes, right? and it was the fact that they wrote, sorry, dear, that really annoyed me. Not that I could potentially get diabetes. I just wrote saying, you're not my, don't call me dear and then say something, you know, horrible afterwards. You know, quite obvious that I'm posting inspirational recipes that people can make at home. This isn't something, I'm not going to sit there and eat like a triple. And even if I did want to eat it all by myself, who cares? Like, why is it your business?
It feels like with social media, people just can't wait to take something away from you. The joy of something.
It's a shame, but I do think there is, I don't know, I've always been really honest on my platform. I think when it comes to social media, you know, if you look through all of my Insta stories and stuff, it's all about homely, unashamedly kind of raw type of cooking, if that makes sense. I do fine dining and I love fine dining and I enjoy creating fine dining and bespoke meals for clients, but my passion is in the easy to kind of read kind of recipes, the ones that people can replicate at home and share that with their own families, because I really do think that's part of what I'm here to do, is to help others create those kind of memories in their own homes.
Which is definitely extended when you're having people come in to learn and cook with you, and also your outreach programs that you're getting people. I believe at some point you were having students from challenging backgrounds to come in and learn to cook as an inspiration. What, in terms of what your restaurant can do, what's your philosophy?
I don't know if I've got a definitive answer for that in terms of my wider agenda, but I definitely know that we have, I think a lot of businesses think of their CSR, and because I'm such a small business, it's just me and my head chef and my general manager, we sort of often sit around and just think about what more we can do. So particularly in lockdown, we all realized that we were closed, but we all know that we can cook. So we just use that to our best advantage and prepared meals for the NHS and for homeless charities and for those who are much more disadvantaged than us. So a couple of the schools which deal with the, like the the most deprived children in Southampton. So we just thought every week, right, where are these meals going to go? And let's think about this carefully. So I think that there's a lot that we can continue to do. I don't actually have an outreach program as such, but I definitely think I'd like to do something much more consistent with what we have at the restaurant, for sure.
I mean, obviously the in the news recently, just seen about Marcus Rashford trying to get the free school meals, and it just, from my work with the Saints Foundation and what could be done. And yet at the same time, you have to be a profitable business. It's finding the right thing to do. That in itself must be very challenging to not just at this time, but as an owner of a restaurant, looking after various jobs that have to be done. How much is that playing on your mind at times?
Well, when we closed the restaurant, my first issue was I need to protect all my staff. You know, it's their livelihoods. They've got families to support. They've got homes that they need to pay for. And, you know, this is what being a business owner is being accountable. And that accountability has to be an honest accountability. So as soon as we closed, I got everyone together and just said, look, I want to reassure you that none of you are going to lose your jobs. So I'm going to do everything I can to keep you paid, so I'm not gonna, you know, drop you off the edge of a cliff. And then about 2 weeks after that, that's when the furlough scheme was announced. So there was at least support from the government, and the government support has been very much welcomed. As a small business, we've had lots of other logistic issues, such as still having to pay commercial rent, which has been quite hard considering we've got zero income. But equally, knowing that we have zero income, but then we're all skilled chefs, knowing that we can use that to our advantage. So even though it costs money to prepare those meals, the outcome is people are going to receive those meals who really, really need it. And what's better than being able to use our skills to that advantage, really?
Definitely. Definitely. It's been brilliant to see on Instagram, and some very happy, maybe not the most knowing what to do in the photo NHS staff, but they've got the food, the stacks of food that you were able to make for them. And hopefully, as you try with your food to get people to try new things, that in an odd way, getting more people maybe to try that wouldn't have come to your restaurant necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely wasn't the first thought. I thought about it afterwards, and I thought, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done curry for these guys. Maybe they should have, you know, maybe I should have done something simpler. But then again, that's me. You know, I always question whether or not I've made the right choice. I think that's just, you know, that's just me and who I am. But I, you know, afterwards I remember thinking, oh, maybe they've never had Mauritian food before, so it's been probably a welcome change. And the feedback that I did get from everyone as well, we loved the flavors, we loved, you know, the presentation and things like that. So it was lovely. And, you know, some of the kids that got back to the school saying that, you know, that was one of their first hot meals they'd had in a while. And that was something that really hit a chord, that there's so much more that we could all be doing collectively.
Yeah. Hopefully we as a society learn from this pandemic time and moving forward. Understanding and hearing the story of how you got on MasterChef, you sent the picture in, you eating lobster spaghetti with a bib on, the no airs and graces, just you love food and you know to experience all those different food flavors, and you got through. 25,000 applicants attended for that or applied in 2012. At that point you then have to get involved with the books, writing the books, and then lots of guest appearances on TV shows, on the Food Network, and turning up to cook for people at Leaf's cookery school. Like, just in terms of the challenges and what that's brought out in you, were you like a duck to water in terms of being in front of a camera, or has it taken a bit of time to find out who you are?
I think there's two sides of it, really. I think that MasterChef has the ability to allow someone like me, a woman who is of colour, to get into an industry which is notoriously laden with men who are in the head chef positions, who are majority white. So in that respect, you know, if we're talking on a diversity perspective, it really opened up doors for me, which is incredible. And the opportunities that I got, I'm really thankful for. The 2-book contract with Penguin, and then going on to doing my stints on TV and radio has been incredible. My ultimate goal was always opening a restaurant, and I do struggle. I do think that the industry has its own complexities, in the sense that it still is not absolutely representative. I mean, if you watch any food show, you'll see that it does lack diversity, that there is still a significant amount of men occupying the space. And I think there are some female voices out there that are becoming more and more, it's becoming more salient that they're around. So I think that's really, really good. But I do think, for me, within the restaurant, I can make more changes. So I can employ different types of people from lots of different backgrounds who may not have had the opportunity to cook in a restaurant. So I do think that by having my own restaurant and making those choices independently, I can try and make the world change a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that's admirable to be able to do that. Or what's in your circle of control, I guess, is what you're saying. The industry, it seems from an outside perspective, it is able to create people and then do what they want with that person, and you get caught up in the machine, I guess. But what you're able to create within your control, it's your restaurant, you can do what you want. The industry doesn't tell you how to be. But how did you learn to be able to present and to share your recipes in a TV environment?
It's weird, because I've always been really good at presenting, because my old job took me into really challenging places. So I would be in a role where I would be having to challenge senior people about the way that they, you know, they take on new staff, and it was always challenging. So I had to be careful with the way that I presented, and I had to be influential in different ways. So I never worried too much about presenting. And I think when you talk about food that you love and you're passionate about, I can just talk, I mean, like I am now, I'm just talking for ages about food. So I think in that respect, I never got any acting training. I never got any presentation skill training or anything like that. I think the only thing is meeting other people. That's where the difficulty came about. So I didn't mind the physical being filmed for cameras and all that kind of stuff, but it was the networking and being friends with people in the industry. I really struggled because I'm not like the people in the industry. I didn't feel like I really fit in.
Is that because of the way you are or the terms of why did you feel you didn't fit in?
I think a lot of the events, I mean, particularly in the first 2-3 years, I was invited to lots of really high profile events. And these events are people that all know each other, people that get jobs based on knowing each other. You know, there is the issue of nepotism. And actually, if you don't know these people and you're not from their background, you know, I'm not from a wealthy background. I didn't read classical poetry. You know, I'm a girl from Southampton who has moved around a lot, and you know, I'm not from a wealthy background. We're not middle class, nothing like that. So for all of those reasons, I didn't fit in because I didn't have the same story to share with others. The only story that I did have to share was that I did MasterChef, and people were excited to hear that. But further than that, I didn't feel that I really kind of, I don't know, I just didn't fit in, and I didn't feel comfortable going to these events. But then eventually, like, other people started to win shows. I'll give you an example, like Nadi Hussein. Mm. When she won Bake Off, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I reached out to her, and we actually message each other now and then. So there's things like that where you develop friendships. She invited me to her launch party, her book launch. And it was the first time I'd gone to a networking event, which I felt totally myself at. I could be comfortable in. I felt like I could talk about myself and, you know, just be me, which was amazing, really. And there are more of those happening now, I do feel. But when I first won, I didn't feel that that was the case.
In terms of those celebrity moments that you've met someone that was maybe inspiring to you or was shocked, or you were shocked that they'd seen you on MasterChef. Was there any moments like that you had?
Recently, actually, with Judy Love. So she asked me to be on her radio show about, I think it was about 6 weeks ago. And her producer got in contact saying, Judy really loves you. And I was like, what? Judy Love loves me? I've been like following Judy for years. so that was just one example just recently. There was another example of when I was on MasterChef, actually, and I had completed one challenge with Michelle Roux Jr. and finished. And then about a year later, actually probably about 6 months later, I went to an event and he was there. And Michelle Roux Jr. is a legend. I absolutely adore him. And he is as nice as he comes across on TV. So it's so lovely to meet people like that. And I was at an industry event, and out of nowhere, he came up to me and said, hi, Shalina, how are you? And I thought, my God, he remembers my name. And, you know, it was a proper jaw-dropping moment. I thought, Michelle Roux Jr. knows my bloody name. That's it. You know, I'm happy. I can live life, you know. And, you know, and he sat there and he gave me some tips and he told me what I needed to do and how to improve and how am I finding everything. And it was just wonderful. He gave me real time. And it's moments like that that I really, really value. Those kind of inadvertent mentors who gave me those moments in time that helped shape who I am now, really.
Yeah. Is that one of the fundamental attributes that you look for in people, is them giving you their time? Is that one of the criteria that you look for in other people?
I think authenticity is what I look for. I think you always know when someone's being their authentic self. And if they are, then I really welcome that, particularly in the food acting world or whatever, TV industry, let's call it. I think being your true authentic self is a rare treat. So when I find that and I see it, I really search it out and want to be around those kind of people.
Yeah, definitely. My final question to you, Shalina, what does the future have in store for you?
Oh, I don't know. My brain has been in lockdown mode. So we are looking now at exploring how we're going to be reopening and what that's going to look like. So it's going to be a phased reopening of the restaurant. We're going to be introducing a couple of more items to our delivery menu. We're going to be introducing La Casa Mama at home, where people can take food from our restaurant and warm it and cook it at home, basically. Mm. There's lots that we're looking at. So I think the next couple of next few months are going to be quite challenging for a lot of people in hospitality. But I'm just looking forward to reestablishing the brand and seeing how we can get through the next year, in all honesty.
Are you one of those chefs that, are you one of those cooks, Shalina, that at the restaurant will come out and chat to people who are dining in your restaurant?
So I actually have a head chef at the restaurant now, Maria, who's Greek, and she runs the restaurant. And I also have a general manager. So I am now really in logistics. I do all the business management. And when I go into the restaurant and cook, it's normally that I'm cooking new recipes and new content. But it always means that I'm able to talk to everyone whenever I'm there. So I'll just make sure I chat to as many of my customers as possible. They're who make who we are. So, why wouldn't I?
Well, look, I thoroughly look forward to actually, and I know it sounds awful and I'm back there.
You haven't been yet, have you?
this was the one confession. I decided I wasn't going to say at the beginning of the podcast, but obviously working at Southampton Football Club and most Saturdays, I'm, you know, down the A3 and then back up again immediately. I'm normally doing a stand-up gig in the evening.
We are around the corner. It's like a 7-minute drive from the stadium over to the restaurant, okay?
Well, it's just, to be honest, as you know, the traffic is very busy after a match day. I really look forward to coming to, obviously, researching your menu and everything you serve. I can't wait. It's awful when you look at Instagram and you see such amazing food on your Instagram page. I'm like, it's annoying that I can't try that food there and then, but I know that it's something to look forward to. Well, thank you so much for being my guest.
No problem.
Well, there you go. As soon as it's open, I'll be along to Shalina's restaurant. What a great insight into a truly authentic character that is Shalina Permalloo. We got into so much in that chat. If you want to find out more, then I strongly suggest you go to see her Instagram. You'll be struck by a wave of colour and delicious looking food that, if you're like me, you can't wait to try. I have a pang actually right now in my stomach to eat my mum's home cooked food. If you have enjoyed the show, do spread the word. You'll find all of the details about the show in the podcast info. Right, until next time and my next guest, be safe and catch you soon.